You know, as you know, this point will come up several times, but you cannot be forced to reveal something you just do not know. We can even make sure, apply that to the information itself. Snapchat for whistleblowing is, in fact, something you can do and make tips disappear after a period of time of inactivity. Well, what about OPSEC? Well, you know, you'd think that a lot of people would be willing, you know, who are willing to risk blowing the whistle is going to be able to, you know, research and do, you know, OPSEC. They're not, they may not be perfect, but, you know, that's not, you know, you'd think that that would be a decent place where you can start with your assumptions. And, you know, finally, you'd think you'd have a crack team of IT ninjas that would be helping to make sure that the platform is in tip-top shape at all times. Would you say, would you know, show of hands, would you say that that's a pretty good place where to start? Okay, that's a surprisingly few number of hands. Okay, well, moving right along. Well, the fact of the matter is what I described is completely impractical. And we're going to dig into why it's completely impractical in a moment. So let's start with by defining the problem. What is whistleblowing? Whistleblowing is the practice of informing on someone to putting a stop to something else. My notes just decided to disappear on me, and I don't have my slides. When people think of whistleblowing, they think of, you know, a lot of people think of revealing stuff to the media. You know, Pentagon Papers, Watergate, Clarol murder. Those sorts of things are what the general, a lot of people in the general public think when they think about whistleblowing. The truth of the matter, though, is it's actually kind of rare that whistleblowing like that goes mainstream. Hollywood's depiction at best is unrealistic about whistleblowing. Most whistleblowing is never known by the general public. You know, and a fair number of people in this room have probably been whistleblowers in some regard and have never considered it in such ways. You know, for example, all the following is a type of whistleblowing. For example, how's my driving? You know, it's a type of whistleblowing. OSHA violations, workplace type of whistleblowing. Or my personal favorite, GPL violations. It's also a type of whistleblowing. Apologies. They are, you know, the fact is they're all, they all have things in common. One person is informing on another to try and stop bad behavior. The informant may or may not have to identify themselves and what they know to aid that. And if the whistleblower's identity is revealed, they can be open to retaliation. I mean, these are all low-stake environments. It's not all that likely, you know, someone's going to go out and hunt you down for revealing, you know, informing on any of this. But it's got the same basic characteristics at its heart. So let's talk about the types of whistleblowing. There are more than this, but these are essentially four main categories. The first, and the one that most people are familiar with, is investigative journalism. You also have cases of corporate compliance, where whistleblowing is done within an organization. Tax whistleblowing, because the IRS actually loves getting tips about these sort of things. And finally, you have anti-corruption, NGO, and watchdog organizations. And the needs and requirements of these organizations and what happens to an information when a tip is received drastically varies from type to type, which we will get into a little later. But before that, let's look at what's common in all that, and that's the whistleblower and their needs and requirements. Okay. The fact of the matter is, your whistleblowers are not going to be OPSEC masters. In fact, they may be aware of Tor, they may have heard of it, but computer literacy may not be something they have. They may not even own a computer, and they may only have a smartphone. It's unrealistic that a whistleblower is going to be know anything beyond what the general public does, and it really becomes the responsibility of the platform to reduce informant risk in what can be charitably called less than ideal circumstances. Let's start building a more realistic system. Let's talk about the requirements. So, they need to be able to securely communicate with the back, with the platform. You know, using encryption, TLS. But we cannot require that they have an external dependencies. They're not going to be required to download GNU-PG or Tor browser just to be able to use the platform, because a platform that is not accessible is not usable. They need to be able to use it in their own native language, because a lot of times a whistleblower may not be fluent in the dominant language of where they're living. And the platform needs to be able to protect him in less than ideal circumstances. Now, obviously, this is a fairly generic list, but it's four basic points that need to be there just to have the start of a system. But information doesn't exist in a vacuum. There, you know, what about the receiving organizations who get this information and have to act on it? Well, let's talk about the other side of the spectrum. Receiving organizations, I don't have a fancy definition for these like I did for whistleblowers, but they're basically any organization that receives sensitive information and acts on them. They often have unique legal challenges, political, technical barriers that you really don't see in a lot of other places. This is also true for cases where the receiver organization is a government agency, as well as privately owned ones, such as media organizations. And these are becoming more and more organizations are starting to get involved with whistleblowing. Relatively recently, Italy passed a law, 190/2012, that requires quite a few organizations to have whistleblowing platforms and be able to accept tips and must be able to operate on it. And that's just one of many that are starting to spring up in the EU. So year after year, more organizations are getting involved with some sort of whistleblowing than we have seen in the past. So let's look a little bit more in depth, and let's start with investigative journalism. Okay, so my slides are now advancing. Journalist organizations, they want to take a tip and they want to publish it as far as wide as possible. The journalists don't have, you know, direct political power. They can't change policy, they can't, wave a magic wand. But they do have something that most other organizations don't. They have a direct line into the public. So when they publish something, it's going to get in the hands of a lot of people very, very quickly. And it is essentially the whistleblowing equivalent of letting the genie out of the bottle. Once the information is out there, it can be acted upon and hopefully force policy change. Now, the interesting thing about investigative journalism is it's generally where we can use the best technological protections on both ends, but it's also where the greatest types of liabilities come into play. So it's an interesting case to look a little bit more in depth when we try and define system requirements about whistleblowing. And again, the protections for journalists and whistleblowers in the United States, they generally fall under freedom of press laws and shield laws. Here, it's been defined by case law for the most part as applied to the First Amendment. And the two I'm going to talk about briefly is the New York Times versus the United States. And this was the very famous court case that came about as the Pentagon Paper leaks. The long and short of it is that the publication of classified or sensitive information relating to government actions is protected free speech, except where such cases would cause grave and irreparable harm. So the government cannot apply prior restraint and censor the information or prevent it from being published. For leaks against private organizations, this falls under libel and defamation laws. The legal standard here is essentially if the publisher knew that at the time of publication that the information was either false or acted with reckless disregard, they are more or less immune. So what does this actually mean, though, as far as protections and security? Well, it means that journalistic organizations such as the New York Times, they're essentially bulletproof. As long as they stay within the very broad guidelines that I just outlined. That being said, that's not true of individual reporters or whistleblowers themselves. Reporters can be forced to subpoena their sources, and shield laws in this country are a little bit all over the place. 49 of the 50 states have shield laws to protect reporters, but there is no federal shield law. The appellate courts currently are split on the concept of reporter's privilege, that a reporter does not have to disclose their sources. But there's a circuit split. So some appellate courts have ruled one way, some have ruled another. There has been no case of the Supreme Court to resolve this one way or another. So for federal law, and there's no federal shield law, so there it is at best an ambiguous situation. Whistleblowers have even less protection. There are a couple states, once again, have their own patchwork of laws. There are some federal whistleblowing laws. Most of them, though, relate to either people working in government positions or in certain specialty fields. The Supreme Court of the United States has also ruled that those protections do not extend as far as public disclosure. So, where do we go from here? So, the fact of the matter is, not all threats are legal. You know, this is just what can be done in a court of law. It actually goes quite a bit beyond that. When you blow the whistle, you can tick off some very powerful people. And beyond legal threats, it is completely possible for less than legal means to be used in terms of retaliation against both journalists, newspapers, and whistleblowers. There have been known cases where whistleblowers and journalists have been either assassinated or died under suspicious circumstances not long after revealing information to the general public. And I'm going to highlight one of these cases right now. This is the case of Marilyn Garcia Esperant, and I hope I'm saying this correctly. She was both a whistleblower and a journalist, and in her career, she exposed quite a bit of corruption within the Philippines Department of Agriculture. In 2005, a man broke into her home and shot her dead over dinner. During court proceedings, it was revealed that the hitmen involved in this operation were directly hired by officials of the Department of Agriculture. At the time, she was one of 32 journalists that had been killed in direct relation to their work in the Philippines. So, when people blow the whistle, they are risking everything. I'm not exaggerating this. It has happened. It'll continue to happen. So the question is, what can we do to protect them? Well, we can definitely design a system that at least reduces the risk, if not outright eliminate it. So let's go look at that realistic design slide, and let's actually fill the blanks in. There we go. So we may not be able to mandate the use of Tor or another anonymization technologies, but we can still support them and make them first-class citizens in their ecosystem. We should make the best-case scenario completely viable if it can be done. We also want to make sure we are not retaining anything we don't need. We don't want to hold on to IP addresses, browser logs, anything and anything. You know, basically, the bare minimum of what we need is what we should have. And then we need to compartmentalize this information. You know, journalists generally, you know, a large newspaper is going to have a lot of journalists. Those journalists are going to have their own sets of informants. If the information is isolated, it prevents the information from spreading farther than it has to. But this also needs to extend as far as system administrators probably do not need to know the intricate details of who someone is or what they've informed on. So we need to have built-in isolation on the platform. And, you know, it's fairly obvious, but the platform needs to be able to defend against hardened attacks. So now we've got a basis set of requirements for investigative journalism. There's, how does it hold up when we look at some of the other use cases? As I mentioned before, investigative journalism is only one type of whistleblowing, and it's not even the most common. But the platform requirements are not that different, or are they? So let's look at anti-corruption. The anti-corruption platforms are unique. They're one of the few that are run by both government agencies and by non-government organizations. You even see them within corporations that are trying to root out corruption within. That's what we call internal whistleblowing. External whistleblowing is when you're receiving tips from the general public and then acting on them. The end goal in anti-corruption whistleblowing is to basically use the types to directly fight journalism. Directly fight corruption. And the information that comes from an informant can be directly used, you know, in various ways, up to and including criminal cases of law. It's even possible for a tipster to be required to testify in criminal cases. And for those who are familiar with U.S. law, there is a slight problem when you try and mix anonymity with this. Specifically, the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says in part that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with witnesses against them. So, remember that part where I said anonymity? That's how I felt when I first began to understand the requirements about whistleblower disclosure. The fact of the matter is that legal statute pretty much can stop best practices in its track. In a lot of cases where whistleblowing is happening under legal frameworks, it is required that whistleblowers must disclose their identity at some point within the process. For example, the previously mentioned Italy 190 law, it does not require receiver organizations to act on anonymous tips. The whistleblower must reveal their identity for an organization to actually be mandated to act on them. And there we go. And this goes, and what was most surprising to me when I started in this is that disclosure actually is commonplace in all types of whistleblowing. It exists for a few reasons. Sometimes it's to help build trust between a whistleblower and an informant. In other cases, the disclosure is required to help protect people against false claims, you know, because if you have to put your name and say accuse someone of something, it's going to help prevent, if not stop, people from making up scandalous or libelous claims about others. But this can go a bit further. Depending on the exact laws in play, the use of anonymous technology such as Tor can actually make life more complicated rather than less in meeting these requirements, and thus can be contraindicated, and we must retain certain information in those cases. This can actually go as far as using various GOIP databases to track tipsters' origins where they're accessing the platform from. And there we go, third slide. And the fact of the matter is that this information sometimes has to be retained from years upon end. And when the information is online and in the platform, it means it remains susceptible to being compromised if something should go wrong. Cases, you know, and if the case is going through the legal system, that may be years upon years. In other cases, it may be there indefinitely for large amounts of, and a large number of cases. You know, and finally, it always has to be accessible and exportable because sometimes the information has to leave the platform and be handed off to third-party organizations. So it just can't exist in this encrypted soup that, you know, cannot be, that never leaves. So these are essentially mutually exclusive goals. If we look at the previous slide where I laid out what investigative journalism and what anti-corruption requires, that's a lot of things we struck out there. And if we go back right to the beginning where I postulated the ideal system, there's only one point still going, and then I had a thought. Is this your IT department? And in which case, yeah. Now, this is not what I would call a rosy picture, but it's not as bad as it sounds. The fact of the matter is that I didn't choose these arbitrarily. These represent two extremes in whistleblowing. On one end, anti-corruption whistleblowing has some of the more stringent laws and requirements around it, while investigative journalism requires the most protection. But a lot of other cases fall in the middle. Like, for example, law enforcement agencies often can collect anonymous tips. And in that case, their platform is going to look a lot closer to what journalists are using than the anti-corruption cases are going to. Conversely, government tax whistleblowing, that's going to look pretty similar to anti-corruption whistleblowing. So the thing is that the one point that stayed in common through all this was the need for a strong and secure platform. And the, And if you have a strong and secure base, well, you can work around that. Like, so if one organization cannot support Tor, but another organization can, well, does it actually hurt that the code base natively supports it as long as there's an off switch? You know, and a lot of the stuff that goes into hardening and protecting, well, that's going to be common for all use cases, you know, because a compromised platform is going to ruin everyone's day. So why are my slides not advancing again? So basically, a flexible system can meet everyone's needs. The worst case scenario actually isn't quite as bad as it sounds. You know, we can still use TLS. We can still use certificate authorities. I mean, this is good enough for financial information. And in a lot of cases, it's good enough for what we're doing. Because to successfully man in the middle a TLS connection, you've got to do two things. You first need to be able to control one end of the connection or the other and be able to inject packets. And you still need a signed certificate that the browser will accept. That's doable for, you know, if you really, you know, if you're a nation state actor or you own a certificate authority. But it's not trivial. And there are ways that we can complicate man in the middle attacks. And even passive snooping in layer 7, as we'll show in a little bit. We can also, in cases where we can use it, we can distribute as much information as possible and try and get OPSEC higher. You know, if we can get everyone to use PGP, well, we can take full advantage of it. So the fact of the matter is, can we build a better mousetrap? No system is foolproof, and if I stood here and said that, Murphy would strike me down where I stood. But we can make it difficult to get it wrong. And better still, this system actually exists today. The GlobalLeaks platform is basically built to try and be meet all the needs of this and do so in such a way that it's hard to get it wrong. You know, we operate on, we essentially, it's an appliance-like design. You set it up and you run the install script and it sets everything up for you. We support multilingual support pretty much right out of the box. And we've made some technical design decisions that to really try and avoid unintentional retention of data and collection. And for places where we do, we make sure we control it from end to end instead of having third-party applications in the way. And we just basically go with a lot of sane and secure defaults because a switch that, you know, if you have a secure, you know, a switch that says secure, not secure, and the default is not secure, a lot of people are going, you know, it's not uncommon that things are going to get left in the unsecure configuration by default. So let's go right into, you know, let's start showing how this works in practice. Let's start with the install procedure, which is currently three commands in our documentation. You download a script, you make it executable, and you run it. This will download all our support libraries. It will set up your system to run GlobalLeaks, and then it will set it to run by default. So once you run the script, it will grind for about 10 to 15 minutes, depending on your internet speed. You'll get that message at the end, which leads into the installation wizard, which lets you set up, do all the initial setup, which in turn sets up the Tor hidden service and gives you the address. And it just works. That simple. So It doesn't seem like much. I mean, simplified installation of packages, of software has been a staple for quite a few projects over the years. But, it takes a moment to realize really how much we did there. So GlobalLeaks' backend is coded in Python, and we are coded on top of Twisted. For those who are not familiar with it, Twisted is an asynchronous I/O framework for Python, and we are built on top of their web server. So we basically control the stack from layer 3 all the way up to layer 7, and we can control behaviors in it, including making sure we are not directly logging information. The hidden service, it's just set up. We install TorD as part of our setup and connect to its control socket to set up the onion address. We install an AppArmor profile. And for those who are not familiar, AppArmor is essentially a way of defining your application can access these files and no more. And if you try and do it, I'm going to raise a lot of noise in your log files and deny the operation. And it can stop certain exploits from working because they simply cannot the exploit will not be able to reach the resources it needs to actually pop a shell. Because if you don't need access to binsh, well, you can deny it, you can deny access to it. So that goes a long way in just hardening the whole thing. And the platform at this point really needs two things done. You need to set the outbound mail server, and if you need it, you have to set HTTPS. And we actually integrated Let's Encrypt's CertBot and Acme client directly into the browser. Directly into the administrative interface, and can set it up with more than a few clicks. This allows us. This setup allows us to do a fair bit of things because we can also now look at trend lines and other behaviors coming in. Like we can track requests coming in. We can track unusual activity coming to the platform, and keep a trend line of the activity, like submissions coming in, started, failed, succeed, successful logins, failed logins, and basically have an integrated IDS that tries to identify anomalous behavior before that's going on. It may be a false positive, or it may be indication that an attack is underway. So we can prepare, we are not in ideal circumstances. We have to. Come on. There we go. We are in less than ideal circumstances. We need to be able to protect whistleblowers who may not be on secure networks. They may not be even on computers they own. They could be using a workplace computer. So our threat model is realistically going all the way up to nation state attacks. So one of the things that surprised me personally dealing into this is that GlobalLeaks uses JavaScript very heavily on the browser side to the point that we're actually dependent on it. And there is a notion that JavaScript tends to cause security vulnerabilities and not stop them, but we've used it fairly heavily to help strengthen and secure a platform in more than one way. So our front end is called GL Client. It's built around AngularJS, and it basically turns every request you do in the web UI into a REST request. So everything is serialized first on the front end, strongly typed as JSON allows, and then revalidated on the back end. So we always know the type of request coming in. And this allows us to, the entire back end uses REST semantics with a small handful of RPC operations. Now, by standardizing these type of requests, we can validate everything a lot easier, and we don't have to maintain a lot of state tracking information in the back end. So the amount of moving parts on the server, which is the part that if compromised, a lot of people are going to have a bad day, the attack surface is drastically reduced by moving the complexity to the client. It also opens a very interesting possibility that we call browser crypto. And the reason for this is, at its heart, what is JavaScript? JavaScript is a programming language that is Turing complete. And if something is Turing complete, you can do all sorts of interesting things in it, like, encrypt things against PGP public keys. So we prototyped this system, and we call it Browser Crypto. There is, in fact, an entire implementation of OpenPGP in JavaScript, uniquely, obviously enough, called OpenPGP.js. So if we are in a case where we can successfully use PGP and all the receivers have uploaded private keys, we can expose those public keys to the whistleblower, and the whistleblower's computer can actually encrypt the information and send it over the wire in flight. That means nothing unencrypted ever hits our server. It goes end to end. So if the server is compromised, you get a bunch of encrypted files and messages. And if you can break PGP, well, the internet's going to have a bad day. So for the whistleblower, we can make life easy because every time we generate a submission, we generate a semi-random set of numbers. We can use that as a seed for a random number generator and use that to regenerate their private and public key and keep that in the browser, meaning that all ends of the conversation have encryption and we do not have to store the unencrypted things in flight. It's, we can, as long as the software is not compromised, you can make sure you can double encrypt stuff and make sure that the retention is encrypted on the hard drive of the server. So the one problem we ran into this entire system was prototyped and built, and it's not currently merged. We had some performance problems with it, but it's hopefully coming soon in the near future. And this is one of a few ways we've used JavaScript to try and tighten up the experience versus pushing it off to the side. Version 2, I'm not going to give an ETA, but it's very much in the drafting design and hopefully coming soon. So this is the part where man in the middle comes into play, because the thing is that if you are, if we're encrypting in the browser and saying in flight, that's great, but you can't encrypt the JavaScript in flight, and thus an attacker can change it in flight and make your life, break this entire thing. I didn't actually get the point of browser crypto at first, so let me break it down a little bit. Man-in-the-middle attacks, if you've got active man-in-the-middle, you have won. There's no amount of protection we can do that can stop an active man-in-the-middle from, revealing information that it shouldn't. Same thing applies that if you can compromise either an informant's computer or a receiver's computer, you've also won. If you can do it to Tor traffic, you have made a lot of people sad. But what about SSL traffic? Because SSL is underpinned by security certificate authorities. Okay. Well, the fact of the matter is this type of attack is getting hard to pull off. We are currently working, the entire encryption ecosystem is trying to move against defending misissued certificates. We now have certificate transparency, which is something we didn't have 5 years ago. Basically, it allows every certificate ever issued for encryption to be publicly logged and audited, and it is becoming possible that you can mandate that the certificate is logged and exists before the connection will be allowed to go through. That way, no one can issue a certificate for yoursecurewebsite.com without you being able to become aware of it. We now have OCSP stapling and OCSP must staple. We are in a world where SSL revocation can actually work for the first time ever. We now have HSTS, which now enforces and mandates the use of long-lasting encryption and helps to protect against stripping attacks. So, since we are the web server, as I previously indicated, we can essentially do this out of the box and ensure we have a good configuration right then and there that gets as much things as we can resolved. So the other thing you have to realize about man in the middle is it doesn't always interfere with packets in flight. I mean, that's actually a very hard attack to pull off. Not impossible, but it's difficult. So browser crypto can still manage to protect you against passive man in the middle, and that's actually more common than most people realize. I mean, Corporations can deploy an internal root CA and use that to do deep packet inspection. They may not be trying to modify anything in flight, but they may be doing it, looking to see, you know, that malware isn't coming in or out, or checking to see that confidential information isn't leaking. Browser crypto will protect in this case. Some antivirus software also actually does this. I discovered at least AVG installed a root certificate on my system and re-signs every website to make sure I'm not getting infected by malware under Windows. So the browser crypto extensions that we're developing will directly defend against this, and it helps defend us in cases where data could just accidentally leak because these passive man in the middle, and I'm hesitant to say attacks because these do have valid use cases, could accidentally leak information. So it's the fact, you know, it's not as bad as it seems. Now, once again, unfortunately, an active and malicious attack, we can't defend against it, but we might have a chance of at least detecting it through the anomaly detection system, for better or worse. So there is a lot more I want to cover here, and though I actually got through these slides faster than expected. So let's talk a little bit. Every year we've done a penetration test, and we have successfully passed that test. We have integrated protections to limit denial of service attacks. For example, before the client can do upload certain types of operations, such as files and or submissions, it needs to do a proof of work that is designed to take several seconds to resolve. This is to slow down the rate of submission and to prevent someone from accidentally, you know, trying to shut down our platform by filling up the hard drive with a million submissions. In every place where we have an endpoint, we have parameterized and designed schemas to make sure the data coming in is sane and valid. You know, good engineering practice here. And the platform is fully open source. You can go to GitHub, check our source code, and look for yourself to see how we are doing it. So, you know, you don't have to take anything on face value. You can look and see it for yourself. So we can still do better. You know, security is always an ongoing target, and we know that there are areas we can improve. As I mentioned before, we can simplify the installation. A design goal that we want to reach is we don't want to have need to use a command line. We don't even want to limit the amount of Linux knowledge you need. We're looking at adding support to Windows in the near future, as well as integrated support for security transparency and OSCP stapling. We are building out better support for PGP encryption to drastically reduce the learning curve to get there. And if you want to get involved, feel free to come check us out on GitHub or globalleaks.org. So since we have a little bit of time here, I'm going to open the floor to questions. And if you want to reach me after the fact, feel free to do so. So does anyone have any questions? There is a microphone in the middle.
So I was first introduced to GlobalLeaks around 2 years ago, and I was telling all my friends, oh, this is an amazing platform, and everyone was really mad because GlobalLeaks uses JavaScript. So do you think GlobalLeaks will have an interface that not uses JavaScript, or do you think it will use JavaScript forever?
I can't speak definitively, but I do not see JavaScript being removed from GL client. Our design architecture is built around it. So it would be a fairly drastic rewrite to do so. So no, not for the foreseeable future.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, similar question related to the JavaScript. Since like you rely on client-side cryptography, which is done all in browser, and you get all the sources for that client from your application, assuming it's compromised, I have no way of verifying that whatever I'm sending is actually encrypted or even like secure in any way because it's all JavaScript and I'm not gonna read.
Well, the counter I can give there is if the client computer has already been compromised, there is nothing we can do about that. We can't protect against, you know, a compromised computer, you know, In any case where someone has malware installed.
I'm talking about compromised servers. So like if your server is compromised, everyone else is compromised. If my client is compromised, it's only me compromised, right? And if I'm using some client that encrypts with my keys and I guarantee, like I can see the like the signatures of the client, or I can verify the integrity of my client, then I'm sure that whatever I'm saying is encrypted. So like even if the server is now compromised in this case, nobody's gonna read what I sent because it was encrypted and I guaranteed that.
I understand what the question is. That is a use case we are planning to support. It made the slides a little simpler. So if we're cases where someone knows how to use PGP and can use their own keys securely, that's something that is currently supported actually. So does that answer your question then?
Thank you.
Okay.
So, in the interest of hiding in plain sight, so to speak, I'm wondering if the GL client could be implemented in perhaps a native language that could be run on an embedded device, such as, say, a game console, something that, you know, whoever you're whistleblowing against wouldn't exactly suspect as a threat coming into it, though it's Wi-Fi connected and it can run applications that you can pretty much compile for this platform. What I'm saying is a native code version of GL client would probably satisfy a sort of hidden in plain sight sort of use case, as well as being that it's native code, you could download and compile it on your own platform, solving that issue of what if the code on the server being sent to you is no longer trustable that you're running in the browser.
That's actually a very interesting use case, and I had a conversation like that earlier this week. And it's something I would personally like to investigate further. As I mentioned before, essentially what GL client does is it's making REST and RPC backends. Now, that interface is not standardized, but it's definitely possible we could do something like that. I have not personally tried this, but I would not be surprised if we could even get the existing client to run as an Electron app as a stopgap. Again, it would be something to investigate at a further point, but I could definitely see that being a viable thing that could be done with the way we've architected the platform.
Interesting. I'm just thinking with an evil mind, that's all.
Evil minds are the best defense in some ways.
Building upon the previous question, any planned support for WebAssembly?
Not to my knowledge at this time, but I also will not rule it out. A lot of it is we do need to support some smartphones, and I am offhand not completely sure how prevalent support for WebAssembly is and so forth. I mean, we do most of our coding in CommonJS to try and keep platform compatibility as high as it can be.
Hi, thanks for your talk. Have you thought about doing a HackerOne bug bounty program, since you talk about annual pen testing, maybe having a deployed version of GlobalLeaks so it can actively year-round be attacked by good faith hackers?
That is a great idea. I will talk to the people that can make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you then.